never let them lose their seats. So let's hear your hands, let's hear your feet.
You're listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, Asheville's premier soccer podcast.
Guys, welcome back to another episode of You're Smarter Than Us. Guys, today I've got with me Coach Matt Mennell of University of North Carolina Asheville Bulldogs. Thanks for hopping on, Coach.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
So, Coach, your season's quickly approaching. I'm excited about kind of covering it for the pod. I want to take a couple steps back before we get to this year's specific team, though, and talk about your background with the sport a little bit. You were born in Bristol, Tennessee.
That is correct. Just over the hill.
Spent time in the Air Force, and not only spent time, but played for the Air Force. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, from Bristol, Tennessee, which is, so I'm obviously grew up being pretty familiar with Asheville and HFC, and then went to the Air Force Academy, and which was in Colorado, which is kind of a far cry from Bristol, but it really enjoyed my time there as a student athlete, and then, you know, got my first taste of coaching at the Academy, and that kind of sort of, I thought I always wanted to be a coach, and that first job as a right out of college, that was my first assignment was coaching, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. And then, you know, my next assignment was out at LA Air Force Base, so I had to live in Hermosa Beach, California, which is tough, and, you know, I found a way to sacrifice for our country. But while I was there, I was fortunate enough, I worked at a high school and then worked at a JC, and then transitioned to a friend of a friend, Paul Crumpy, who got the head coaching job at Loyola Marymount, knew I was in LA and said, hey, listen, I need a assistant coach guy. I've got a little bit of money. I need you to be able to do goalkeepers. And it just, the way my work schedule worked out. So I ended up working for him and did that for two seasons, and then had the ability and good fortune of my next assignment in the Air Force active duty was going back to the Air Force Academy to teach and to coach. And then, you know, did that for 2 years. And then, you know, it came time to decide whether I was going to kind of go down the career military officer path or go the other way and decide to join the civilian workforce, and was very fortunate, was offered a job in California coaching, and went and talked to my athletic director at the time, it was Colonel Randy Spetman, who went on to Utah State and Florida State's an AD, and he gave me some great life advice, and, you know, and it was awesome, and decided to get out of the Air Force and follow coaching, and went out to Loyola Marymount in 2002 and stayed there until I came to Asheville in 2015. So, you know, kind of a long journey from Bristol. It seems kind of interesting that I went from Bristol all the way across the country to come all the way back to Asheville, but it certainly has kind of worked out well.
So, and in researching your background, I this was so fortuitous that in college, I actually had a lifelong friend of mine that went to LMU. So most of my spring breaks were actually spent on that campus. Even got thrown into the fountain on my birthday 1 year. As is
congratulations, tradition. That's a distinct honor. That's usually they only hold that for stewards. What, you know, I think if you've been there, you know, I really enjoyed my time at Loyola Marymount, and much like Asheville, it's an elite academic institution, and that's kind of aligns with my life goals and, you know, where I want to be. But it was I can't say too many great things about it. It was amazing, and, you know, there's no way for me to properly express my gratitude for the administration and the coaching staff and the great student athletes I got to work with there. And it was awesome, and it was always going to take a special place and a special opportunity to get me to leave, and UNC Asheville was that. And it was hard. It was a hard place to leave, but I mean, it was to come here, it made it a little bit easier.
Did you ever find any of Howard Hughes's secret tunnels in his building?
You know, we bought his building, and next to it's part of the academic building. No, but in one of the first years I was there, interestingly enough, is, you know, you've been there, so you know, just down the bluff, the marshland, and that used to be his runway, but they had to close off probably like a half a mile radius because they found a 2,000-pound bomb. But it wasn't a real bomb. It was a training bomb that had fallen off. So it was filled with concrete, and but it was like it made CNN and everything. Like, they found this bomb in the marsh, and I think they were doing some survey work, and it was interesting. And everybody's like, oh my gosh, they found a 2,000-pound bomb. Fortunately, it wasn't a real bomb, but it was a dummy bomb that they trained with there. But it was, you know, it's a cool place. And Howard Hughes is such a strange interesting, eclectic genius. I mean, it was kind of fun to be there. But yeah, LMU was cool, and it was. You know, I grew up in Bristol, Tennessee, in 1990, and you know, Loyola Marymount was all over the TV. And anyone, I may be dating myself a little bit, but I fondly remember we had snow days during the NCAA tournament, and watching Bo Kimble shoot left-handed free throws. And I just, that story really resonated with me, and it really did. And I was like, that's amazing. And then as I found myself literally, you know, 8 years later working there, and then, you know, 14 years later, you know, being the associate head coach there, I was like, wow, this is really drawn. And then when I came back to Asheville, I mean, I grew up coming to the Biltmore. Like, I've been here. I've been to the Grove Park and all. So it was like, it was really like this sort of, maybe, I don't know if you would call it full circle or karma or fate or whatever, but it just seemed like a really natural fit. None of it was forced. So, but yeah, throw it in the fountain. That's awesome. So we'll have to have another pod where we talk about the intricacies of the west side of Los Angeles. But yeah, it's good.
So while you're out there, you had lots of success. I know you coached the men. You also did some assistant coaching for the women. 5 College Cups appearances with the men, 2 with the women. And you even dabbled a little bit with the LA Galaxy. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, you know, the Galaxy part was a lot of fun. And I was there. I was part of the coaching staff when we started their youth academy. And they're kind of at the tops of it in terms of producing talent and winning games and all the things. But when we started off, they used to have a Sum Cup in Soccer United Marketing, and they used to have a big under 17 tournament. So we did a Sum Cup team for the LA Galaxy, which is a representative team from all throughout Southern California, and helped them kind of put it together. And the director of the academy at the time was a guy named Trevor James. And Trevor James has played at Ipswich, kind of a legend, and, you know, Sir Bobby Robson was one of his mentors. And, you know, when he used to go and visit Sir Bobby Robson at Barcelona, there was a young man who used to pick him up at the airport, a young Portuguese guy. It was Jose Mourinho. So it's like this whole thing comes full circle, right? Yeah, and I remember the first time he's like, yeah, I've got his number in my cell phone. And he showed me, I was like, that's amazing. This is what's at Chelsea. And it was a really special time. And I was very fortunate to know of good players. And one of the players that we brought in to the academy was Giassi's Artis. And to see Giassi blossom at the academy and then go on to Cal State Bakersfield and do wonderful things, and then to see him in the league and see him get signed by the Galaxy, score a bunch of goals, see him do time with the national team. And I think probably and Giassi's a great kid, and he's an awesome young man. He's not a kid anymore. But then to see him be doubted by the critics and then now go to Columbus and have his career kind of have this resurgence, and he's scoring goals. It was awesome. But, you know, there's a ton of players that have gone to various levels of success. Jack McBean, who's now with Colorado Rapids, was in. And, you know, there's a lot of players that kind of cycled through there. But it was certainly an exciting time. And then being there when David Beckham came, that was another part that was awesome. But it was, you know, the Galaxy was a great experience. And it was a lot of work, but it was something I really enjoyed, you know, in my club coaching. But yeah, there's some cool stories, you know, and it was fun to be part of. But yeah, I've never been any place where you have to go and watch a first team training and literally, and it, like 750 journalists, not 750, there were 750 journalists from different publications from around the world to watch training. And that's kind of surreal. Like that kind of media attention is certainly don't see that for soccer here in the United States. But to be fair, that's the kind of media attention that is usually for heads of state. And like to be in that kind of circus it's cool, but at the same time, it reminded me, like, I'm really happy that that's not me. I don't know that anyone wants that kind of attention. And that was a firsthand, even in LA and LA's movie stars, and you see, you know, you see Neve Campbell, you see Shaquille, you see Kobe, you see all these people around. But when there's someone that even the movie stars are like, oh my gosh, I need to be around this person, it's something.
So you came to Asheville in 2015. What was probably the largest like culture shock coming from not just West Coast ball, but successful West Coast ball, and dropping down into the Big South and a smaller conference, you know, at a school where, you know, sports may not be one of the things that, you know, they really put out on the plate?
You know, it's interesting because when I took the job, I think that was the sentiment of a lot of my colleagues, like, what are you doing and why? Now, there are a couple of reasons that I think that we have advantages with of, you know, some are not as to why I came here. But I think the biggest thing is I was very cognizant of that. This isn't a drop down. The Big South is a hard conference, and this is it's challenging. And I think that it's easy sometimes as fans and pundits, and you know, you listen to everyone to say, well, I don't really want to watch MLS, but I want to watch the EPL. And you hear this like, oh, the MLS is crap. This is what I would say to any college kid or anybody that fancies himself a player or anybody that plays in the MPSL or the PDL. The MLS is crap. There's a reason why you're not there, because it is not crap. It's just really hard. But also, too, we have the wonderful ability to compare and contrast to an elite-level league. The EPL is certainly the most marketed, and they've got the best bells and whistles. Like, they have got a real – their branding is phenomenal, and you can go back and – 10 years and they've been tons of marketing studies and teaching classes, like they really got that right. But that league is hard, and the MLS is hard. And the parallel I'm drawing, so when I came to the Big South, I didn't view it as a step down. It's just a different kind of challenge. And certainly here at UNC Asheville, you know, it kind of had some ups, had some downs, but certainly had not had a directional push to what I wanted to do with it. And for me, in talking with Janet Cohn, and she and I had a lot of great conversations, and talking with Terry Burney, my senior women's administrator, you know, they understood what I wanted to do. But this was a project that needed to be holistic in a complete approach. And that was very, very, very interesting and very, very exciting for me. Now, at the same time, I'm not really patient. So I think that for me, I really thought last year we were gonna be better. And now as time goes and you look at it, that's probably a little unrealistic. And our guys played hard last year, and we played good football in this. So if I could turn this into a FIFA game, and you know, you can play the Legends teams, my third year team, last year's team that, you know, we only got 3 results, 2 wins and a tie. Last year's team would beat my previous 2 teams. And my second team played for a Big South title on senior day. You know, chance to be the number one seed. But my third year team would have beaten that team and would have done so pretty comfortably, I think. So that was the hardest part, is being patient with the process. And I know that, you know, Joel Embiid and everyone at Philadelphia 76ers have made it, you know, Colangelo have made this such a great deal, and that it's, you know, the process. But it really is a process. But if you're looking at it from a holistic point of view, you know, this is a great project. And what was so exciting about me doing this, like, I had this vision of what I wanted to do, but then to marry that with a liberal arts university who approaches education the same way, like, I don't know that I could have dreamed up, like, it's like the perfect fit. You add in Asheville's, you know, one of the coolest towns in the country, you know, and it's awesome. And then you have a beautiful, you know, physical landscape in terms of being in Western North Carolina in the mountains. It's pretty easy. But, you know, there's some challenges for sure, and that's, change is hard, and that's, you're either committed to it or you're not. But I don't know that any great process has happened overnight. You know, it's, you know, and I have no desire for this to be a Leicester City type of deal. I'm not interested in catching lightning in a bottle once, you know, at the same time, understanding that, you know, I would love it if I win the lottery. Unfortunately, I did not win the $522 million last night. One guy out in California did. So I don't think there's going to be Man City money coming in, but this is a process, and everything we've done has improved from year to year to year, not only within our men's soccer program, but in terms of athletics as a whole, and that has a lot to do with Asheville as a community.
So speaking of the team last year, you obviously mentioned it didn't quite go the way you thought it was going to. If you could kind of conceptualize that, was that a result of what happened on the pitch? Was it a result of other clubs, well, other schools and their growth?
Yeah, I think yes to all of it. I think as far as our team, I think that we didn't find bounces early. And I felt that as a group, and I thought going into it that our group last year was going to be fine if the sun was on our back. For the sun always to be on your back, you need to find some luck. Certainly we didn't have that. We had some stormy days, and that was challenging. But that group played hard, and they worked hard every day in training, and you know, they didn't quit and they didn't phone it in. So I think as unhappy as everybody is, you know, you're here to win football matches. You know, that part I was really okay with. You know, I don't like losing, but also too, in the grand scheme of things, and this is something that's hard to remind yourself as a college coach, yes, you're here to win games. But in reality, I'm an educator of young people. There are a million and one ways to do it, and you can, in college sports, you can win right away. But it's kind of like trying to get your energy from a candy bar. If you eat a candy bar, you'll get a sugar rush and you'll have a bolt of energy, and then there's going to be the crash and you're going to feel terrible afterwards. Whereas if you eat your fruits and vegetables, that's going to be a proper energy source and a healthy lifestyle. And, you know, I thought the group last year was, you know, it was good. And, you know, but every season is different, you know, and it was certainly, it was not what I wanted, but at the same time, were there valuable lessons? For sure, both positive and negative. And, you know, to be fair, we did a lot of things really right. You know, it's just sometimes you don't get the bounces.
So coming into this year, 2018, just kind of looking over your roster, you've got an extremely young team, lots of underclassmen, a few redshirted freshmen. Well, I guess now they're past that, but they're redshirted. Do you see that as kind of what you were describing about in terms of the longevity of getting those in and teaching them up, coaching them up?
You know, yeah, yes and no. The nice thing is everybody on the roster is has sat on that same couch that you're sitting on and has listen to me talk about what my vision is and has chosen and has been chosen. And I don't think you can put too high a premium on that. And, you know, I think you see it in every sport. You when managers change over, and now that there's a new manager at Chelsea, there'll be a grace period until he gets in his guys. And certainly with, you know, I'm a United fan, and Mourinho at United, it was amazing what he did the first year with not his group. And now with his group, finished second. Of course, it feels like a failure, but he still finished second, you know, and it was, you know, but so they're all my guys that I brought in, and I think that will help in some ways. Also, too, it puts a lot more responsibility both on them and on me, because this is the group. Like, but we are young, but we're pretty talented. Mm-hmm. Our freshman class is fun, and you know, all the way through, we've got 29 guys on the roster for this year, and I think that, you know, all of them are in the mix for playing time. And I think that is, you know, and that's another challenge of the college season is how do I, you know, get those guys integrated, because we don't have reserve games. But I like the group, and I'm excited about where they've been built to, you know, to play a style, and we've got some pieces, and, you know, I don't think we've got too many weaknesses right now in the group, but it's, you know, they're a fun little kind of team to be around.
Can you talk to your recruiting efforts? Because one of the things I found really interesting was, as expected, there's lots of individuals from Raleigh, a few from Charlotte, which is to be expected. But you have several from Wisconsin, one or two from Colorado. How do you go about finding a Taylor Doral?
Well, I mean, Taylor Doral, interestingly enough, plays one of the guys that works up there is a guy named Steve Cornish, who used to be the head coach here a couple versions ago. And Steve left here to go up there. And so Taylor was a player that I saw and talked to Steve about and had a conversation. And, you know, certainly he's, you know, redshirted last year, mm-hmm. Put a little bit this spring. We're excited about him, you know, being a redshirt freshman. And, you know, he was a big boy.
Yeah, like, 6'5" striker. Yeah,
he's a big 6'5". Like, he's, you know, you shake his hand and he's a big old kid.
Yeah, I'm a big guy, and I stood next to him and was like, whoa.
Yeah, he's a big kid. So but I think in terms of our recruiting efforts, areas are great, club coaches, you know, but we have, again, like, I've been very fortunate, and I've been in the game line. If I have a lot of friends, and, you know, I think that anytime you're open to looking at dissimilar places, I mean, you know, the reality is we've got a lot of Asheville kids, and I got four coming in this year, and I'm really excited about that. Now, Asheville's a town of 80 to 100,000, depending on how far you want to cast the metropolitan area, and if you want to include Hendersonville, right? So that's not always going to be the case where we're going to have a lot of players that we want to recruit. And then if that player pool is there, are they all going to want to come to Asheville? One of the wonderful things about Asheville is that Asheville is amazing, but if you've grown up here, maybe it's time, maybe you say you want to go. But for us to have Isaiah and Ben and Evan and Tanner Gilliam, for them to choose us, is pretty awesome. And then, you know, it's a great testament for, you know, working at HFC and having my staff work at HFC. You get to see ins and outs, like, hey, this is a kid that can really help us. And kind of using that remoteness in terms of where is Asheville on the national soccer landscape, kind of use that to our advantage. And, you know, we certainly didn't hide them, and we certainly tried to promote them as best we could. But for whatever reason, people didn't want it. They didn't believe that, you know, the player of the year was ever going to come out of Asheville. And anyone that's seen Isaiah play is, he's different, you know, and he's young, and he's still developing, and but he's different. And to be able to work with different kind of player like that is pretty awesome. It's a great responsibility, and he and I have a lot of work to do, and he'll be the first one to tell you he's got a lot of work to do in this game. But he's different, and if you've ever, you watch him play, you walk away like, okay, that was different than what I saw before. and I hesitate to use any professional examples or any other sports, but there are those athletes that you've seen, and whether it was at a high school basketball game or, you know, a college football game, or even just seeing a pro, you can walk away and you're like, yeah, that person separated themselves from the group. And I think that he'll be a great compliment to the guys we have. But now we are young, but we're kind of talented in spots. Now we're going to have to continue to develop, and we got to put it on the field. But talent is has never really been an issue here. And I certainly don't think that's the case, even how young we are.
So how, in your opinion, would you compare, we kind of talked about this off mic just a second ago, but D1 colleges in the U.S. compared to the academy system in Europe or England, what are the advantages to colleges, and where do, obviously besides the fact that academy players are being paid,
right,
but how do you see that as possibly something in America that is preventing our best from going into soccer professionally?
It's kind of a multifaceted question. I'll take the first part, Alex, for 300. I think that probably the college system is great. I think that our college season, and, you know, there's been a ton of, you know, it should be spread out over the course of a year. Instead of trying to cram this into 3.5, let's spread it to 5.5. Let's reduce the wear and tear on the student athletes. That certainly will allow for the developmental part. Now, the rub with that at the Division I level is a couple of things. One is going to be more expensive, use of facilities, but just for the players, your squad size is going to go down. So if I'm going to break this thing out, I'm not going to need 29 players. In reality, I'm probably going to need 24. So I'm taking maybe 5 guys out of the development part. The other part is, too, is the funding for it in terms of the student athlete. You know, men's college soccer, you're allowed 9.9 scholarships. You're not getting a full boat. They don't exist. And there are some kids that get them, but more often than that, you're having to pay for school. So we get back into this pay-for-play model. So, you know, you ask, well, how does it compare and contrast to the academy system for professional teams, not only in Europe or in South America, but here domestically, is that at the academy systems, kids aren't paying, and they shouldn't be. Why aren't they paying? Because they are, in fact, commodities. The reality is, in Europe, if you aren't good enough to make the grade, then maybe that you get to a lower level team, or maybe you end up doing your apprenticeship and learning how to do your trade. There is... In college, there's a little bit of a safety net. So the way I think that college is good is if a kid's not good enough to go from LA Galaxy 2s to go the first team, you know, they can get to maybe go to college. So that's great. The rub is if I am academy director and I send them to college soccer, where there's certainly a premium placed on winning, and it's only a 3.5-month season, I'm like, okay, I don't know that you're really helping my guy, my player here, to get better so I can bring him back into the fold and hopefully develop him to be a first team asset, and then he's going to become great and I'm going to sell him. And ultimately, it's a business, right? That's kind of the rub, and that's where our disconnect is. I think that you know, the opportunity for college soccer to spread that season out would be great. The hard part is there's a lot of things that go into that. If college soccer was, you know, going to be all over TV and people were going to watch it, and there's a ton of money going into it, a la basketball or a la football, I think it'd be very easy, because then there would be TV revenue and sponsorship dollars to put in, and the colleges wouldn't be able to have any issue. But in college athletics in general, we see it every day. The Power Fives, money is not a problem. At the rest of the NCAA, it can be a problem. And it unfortunately, it's a business. So I have no doubts that Janet Cohn and the rest of the administration are like, hey, Coach Mendel, we'd love to give you the biggest budget in the country. And the reality is that money doesn't grow on trees. And we have the whole student-athlete experience to consider, not just men's soccer. So it's an interesting dilemma. I think it's continuing to get better. But at some point, you know, and right now our best players of the 18 and 19, you know, 17, 18, 19 aren't going to college. I don't think that's a bad thing, because as they go and they've got a chance to be pros and a pathway, the Christian Pulisics of the world. Landon Donovan didn't go to college. That's just giving opportunities for the Clint Dempseys who did go to college. And so when you look at it, our national team, if our national team gets to the point where we have, you know, 23 players who didn't play in college, you know what, I don't see that that's an issue, but then when you look at the MLS, there are a lot of guys that played 4 years, some that played 1 year, some that played 2 years. But, you know, I don't think it's a detriment, but it certainly isn't super conducive. Like, it's not a natural pathway. We have to continue to kind of massage that.
Why do you think so many international players choose when they come to the, well, maybe they're not choosing, but when they come to the U.S., they end up at D2 schools as opposed to D1 schools?
You know, I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, it's an age thing. Also, two, Division II has, I don't want to say, a different set of guidelines to get through the clearinghouse. And certainly, New York Red Bulls and their academy system, as they're managing their prospects and bringing things, they're going to be very mindful of the process, making sure that they don't harm the potential of a young man to go and play in college one day. Certainly that oversight doesn't exist for Europe, not because of negligence or not because of a lack of looking out for a kid, but it's a different country and it's a different system. And certainly as it terms, in terms of soccer, I don't know that the rest of the world really understands the college system. I think you're seeing more and more people go and kind of bridge that gap. But international, and Division II's got a ton of international, so does NAIA, but Division I has got a ton as well. And I think that, you know, what you're doing is the best American players are going to play pro. Some of the second cut of the international guys, they're really good. Are they Premier League good? I don't know. But then they're not yet to make that jump. So they're saying, okay, you know what, instead of going to play for, you know, 600 pounds a week at this club, why don't I go to America, get an education, and then I can still find my way back if I want to because I have a passport. And so I think you're seeing that. And I think that the level of the college game is good. Now, I think there's a danger there as well, is because it's becoming, it's going to be harder and harder for that younger American player who's in a developmental stage and has not yet arrived at 18. A lot of D1 programs, if you're, you know, you're maybe gonna go with a little bit more experienced player, and so it's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. But I think the international player is great, but you know, we have some international guys here, but I don't care where they come from. You know, I just want players that we think are gonna fit well into our style of play and our system and are gonna thrive here academically. And if they happen to be from Raleigh, great. If they're from Asheville, fantastic. If they happen to be from Brazil, yeah, it is what it is. Yeah.
So what would you describe Asheville's style of play as?
You know, I think we're Barcelona, of course, right? I think that we have a couple things, and you know, I'll probably let you and the listeners kind of glean from it. We certainly want to be an attractive attacking football team. I think there's a million and one ways to do that. I think that, you know, a couple of things that we say to our guys all the time, hey, let's pass the guys wearing the same color shirt. But also, too, we want to ask questions. And I think that certainly, you know, I talked about this on the Wise Guys the other day, and someone asked, well, how come how many own goals in the World Cup? Own goals is not a fact of bad defending. Own goals is, in fact, an increased emphasis on attacking play and put in asking questions of the defense. And so there were so many questions asked that defenders are having to make decisions in spots that are terrible places to make decisions. And they're having to make these decisions while looking at their own goalkeeper. That's how the own goal gets to get on the team sheet so much. So I think that Barcelona, you know, and finally, you know, Johan Cruyff's like vision finally came to fruition and everybody's knocking the ball around. And then I think Pep took that, and then he did it in Spain. And I think for what he was trying to do, then he said, okay, there's more to this. I can take this up a level. So he went to Bayern, and he took it up to Bayern to a level, but both at Barcelona and then at Bayern, and I think he realized, he said, okay, there's no one else to challenge me here. So now he's taken it to the Premier League, and now he's like, okay, I can do this. And certainly they won the league, you know, but there were moments where you thought they would falter, and I think it's awesome. And does, do his team still pass you off the park? For sure. But if you look at what City's doing right now, and as a United fan, it pains me to say this, but they're so ruthlessly effective about going to goal. Yeah. And they're so ruthlessly effective in disrupting rhythm. And Pep's teams play beautifully. What Pep's teams do probably better than anyone else is they have a very pragmatic, some would say cynical, approach to defending. If you start to build rhythm, they'll foul you. And that's awesome. And I don't know if it's a way I would do it. I want to win games 5-4, but the way he's doing it is great. So if you ask me what our style, we want to play attacking, attractive football, but also too, we want to win football matches. But I love creativity and I love guys with flair, and we're going to be hard nosed. And I don't think the one thing I've taken great pride in is when people have come and watched our teams in year one, year two, and year three, I haven't heard a single person say, well, you guys don't try and play and you guys aren't exciting. People say, well, yeah, they gave up some goals, and people are like, well, I love what they're trying to do. That's awesome. We're on the right track. Is it a finished project yet? No, we talked about it. It's a process, but we're certainly, you know, it's getting there.
So to wrap up, kind of tell us what the first few weeks of the season looks like, and maybe give us a game that we can circle on our calendars to say, well, if I'm only going to make it out for a game or two, that's going to be the game.
Well, I mean, of course, you know, these are all South Slope Blues. I mean, so the reality is, coming to all the games, we're still in Asheville. We're, you know, the blues a little bit of a different hue. We got scarves. It'd be great. you know, I think that, you know, our guys are in on the 8th. So we'll do, you know, a media day and pictures and all the stuff. And we'll be in on the 8th, and we'll start on the 9th. And then we are immediately 2 days out, we're going to play at Northern Kentucky, kind of do kind of a closed door kind of, let the Northern Kentucky wants to find out where they are. We want to find out where we are. Then we're going to go down to Mercer on the 14th, a couple days later, again, kind of figure out, you know, maybe now that some of the rust has kicked off, kind of let it take shape. And then our final dress rehearsal will be the 18th of August at home on, you know, move-in weekend for the university. We'll play Georgia Southern. And then we kick off the season on the 24th at Wright State. And that's going to be a pretty good game. And Wright State's very physical, very direct, very effective kind of group. And, you know, when I say those are not negative terms. That they're going to ask a ton of questions for us, and that'll be great. It'll be great for us to answer. But I think if you were going to look at a game that you wanted to come see here, I think that probably you'd have to go with our conference opener. We just added USC Upstate to the Big South. So, you know, just because of some scheduling quirks, we're going to open up conference play on the 31st of August on Friday night at 6. And that should be awesome. And, you know, Scott Halkett at USC Upstate, he's doing a really good job, and I'm really excited for the brand of football he's going to try and play. And you look at the schedule that they're playing, he's certainly gone out and challenged himself, and I think that's awesome. That's going to make our conference better. So if you, I think that'd be a great one. And then, you know, I think play, if people come and watch, and I think it's a cool little atmosphere. And, you know, for those of you that, you know, that know and like the game, I think you'll kind of watch and be like, hey, you know what, this is kind of fun. You know, it's our surface is a little bit better than Memorial.
Doesn't take much.
You know, I don't know that we're going to have all the accoutrements that people enjoy at Memorial during the games in terms of entertainment and food and the like. But I do think that it's we got a great group of young men that are great representatives of UNC Asheville and great representatives of our city. And also, too, I think that we've got enough fun names and guys for the South Slope Blues to get behind. And, you know, also too, I mean, not many other places got a 6'9" center back, so
it's pretty good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Coach. We'll be speaking to you throughout the season.
Awesome. Thanks.
I guess that's why they call us the Blues. Time on our hands could be time spent with Bruce. Drinking like tourists, yelling like drunkards, scoring some sunners, we'll win you over. And I guess that's why they call us the Blues.
You've been listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, a proud member of the Soccer and Sweet Tea Network. Check us out on social media at your_smarter, or shoot us an email at yoursmarterthanus@gmail.com.